From the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University, this is Trending Globally. I'm Dan Richards. This December marks 4 years since the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in Wuhan, China. And while we're all still grappling with this illness in our daily lives and our communities, we wanted to take this episode to look at how these 4 years have changed our society and specifically our approach to public health. What lessons have we learned, and are we better protected now than we were in 2019? On this episode, you'll hear from two experts at the Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health about the surprising ways the last 4 years have changed, and hopefully will continue to change, global public health. Jennifer Nuzzo is the director of the Pandemic Center. She's an epidemiologist and a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. We'll hear from her in the first part of the show about how COVID-19 has reshaped our society and why, as she hopes, life will never quite go back to how it was before. In the second half of the show, you'll hear from Wilmot James, an internationally recognized leader in the fields of global health, international security, and the intersection of the two. And as you'll hear from him, the last 4 years have changed how biological threats are assessed in the international security community, and not just because of the pandemic.
It's COVID-19, but it's also the Russia-Ukraine war. It's one thing to have pandemic response in times of peace, which is hard enough. So we have to think very carefully of what pandemic response means and prevention means in situations of civil strife and war.
First, here is my conversation with the Pandemic Center's director, Jennifer Nuzzo. Professor Jennifer Nuzzo, thank you so much for coming on to Trending Globally.
Thanks for having me. Thrilled to be here.
This past May 5th, 2023, the World Health Organization ended its official designation of COVID-19 as a public health emergency. What does that actually mean? Do they have specific, what are their metrics? And like, what does that signify to you?
In truth is, it doesn't really mean a whole lot. First of all, just to recognize the word pandemic isn't really one that has an official designation. What WHO does have the formal authority to declare is something called a public health emergency of international concern. You know, I think the decision to declare COVID-19 no longer public health emergency was reasonable on the grounds that are typically used, meaning what level of international coordination are necessary, what kind of resources. It doesn't mean that COVID-19 is gone, and it doesn't mean that COVID-19 isn't still a serious threat. It very much is. But in terms of the day-to-day workflows of international organizations and national governments, clearly things had changed by that point, and ending the emergency, I think, made sense. But the reality is COVID is going to be with us for the foreseeable future, just as the same virus that caused our last pandemic in 2009, it was a flu virus. We see that every flu season. So these viruses don't go away, and it really illustrates why even if any designation of a quote-unquote pandemic changes, the work of battling these viruses very much continue.
How would you recommend people sort of think about and approach COVID-19 right now? I mean, obviously it's going to be very different for different people, but you know, it's clearly a very different thing than it was 3 years ago for much of the world, but it's still, as you said, very much with us. Are there ways you think are most helpful for thinking about the risks of individuals or groups mm-hmm. or parts of the world that are more at risk?
So I think that it's worth thinking of the virus that causes COVID-19 not too dissimilarly from how we would think of other serious respiratory viruses. So, you know, this fall and winter here in the Northern Hemisphere, we have to think about not only our risk of contracting the virus that causes COVID-19, but also other important respiratory infections like influenza or RSV. For each of those three, we now have tools that can help us protect ourselves against those viruses. And there are groups of people for whom those tools are particularly important. So in the case of COVID-19, there is now a new booster that's available for people who have not been recently infected, and it's been some time since their last booster. That is particularly important for people who are at high risk of severe illness, and that remains people of advanced age and people with underlying health conditions. We also have medicines that can be used to treat people who are infected, and particularly important for people who are at high risk of severe illness. And so knowing when you need that medicine depends on having a test. We now have more tests available. And so I think what we are going to see is that we have these respiratory viruses that are going to continue to pose risks, that continue to pose high levels of severe illness, and for which we have more ability to prevent, and we just need to better avail ourselves of the protections that we have available to us.
So you describe these multiple respiratory viruses and how the catastrophe of COVID-19 changed how many of us think about all of these illnesses. I think we all think about the flu differently now than we used to, or at least many of us do. And this reminds me of a comparison you've made before to another catastrophe that sort of changed the way people think about a key aspect of public safety. This catastrophe was the Great Baltimore Fire of 1904. What was that disaster? And what are the main lessons you think we in the present dealing with a pandemic can take from how that changed the world back then?
Yeah, so I began thinking about fires in part because throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, I kept getting questions of sort of when is it going to end? When is it going to be over? When do we go back to normal? And as someone who has made a career out of studying pandemics and trying to understand what we need to do to be better prepared for them, I always find those questions a little bit frustrating because I felt like inherent in the question of when will it be over was a belief that once it's gone, we won't have to think about it anymore. We don't have to worry about it anymore. And that by extension, we won't have to worry about anything else anymore. And I certainly don't want to scare people, but I want to equip people to be able to live lives that are, you know, rich and full of all of the activities that we want to do, but also safer from the threats that these pathogens will increasingly pose to us. So I was looking for analogies, and I started thinking about how when we put out a fire, we don't automatically assume that we will never again have another fire. And so that made me start to think about the times that fires have posed really great societal risks to us. I was living in Baltimore at the time, and I was very fascinated by the Great Baltimore Fire of 1904. And one of the things that I learned was that fire was really quite important, in part, not just because of the kind of devastation that it really wiped out like a significant part of the city, but also it was really galvanizing in terms of how the country thought about fires and how it approached fighting them and making ourselves safer from them.
As Jennifer explained, fires like this helped lead to changes to our legal system, to our building codes, and to our everyday culture that we now largely take for granted.
Sure, things could still catch on fire, but, you know, we have seen over the decades since then a change in building codes now that we use fire-safe materials. We have seen a change such that we expect to see fire alarms in buildings. We have seen a professionalization of how we fight fires, and we have seen the building and maintenance of fire departments throughout the countries that are equipped and ready to go, and frankly maintained even when we haven't had fires for a while.
As a society, we got better not only at fighting fires, but identifying them and, crucially, preventing them.
What they effectively did was sort of brought down our risk, right? It brought down our vulnerability. And the more I started reading about that, the more I saw the parallels to thinking about pandemics and thinking about how we can take action to make our environment less vulnerable, to make our society better equipped, to bolster our defenses, to improve our data that would allow us to spot future disease events earlier and act more swiftly and more effectively so that we don't allow them to just simply wash over us. It doesn't mean that we have to stay in our houses and never go out for fear of contagion, but that our society is better equipped to handle contagion such that we reduce its impact on our society.
I used to be a carpenter in another part of my life, and fire is always discussed in the building trades. You know, it was like so many decisions were being guided by fire. Yet at the same time, I've never seen a house fire in my life. But it's like there's a culture that it's like, yeah, we spend a lot of time talking about fire and we don't see much fire. And those two are kind of related.
They're so related. We have worked so much since 1904 to understand the fire threat and what we need to do to protect ourselves from it and make ourselves less vulnerable to it, that it's just kind of part of our subconscious. We haven't yet done that with pandemics. We're actually, I think, better much. I mean, if people often ask me if there's sort of an upside of COVID, and you know, it's hard to see much upside in a disease that has killed millions, but I do think our understanding of pathogens and the steps we can take to protect ourselves has changed.
And so what are some examples of the equivalents of making good building codes and making, you know, flame retardant furniture, mm-hmm. like these ways that maybe you would like to see society more consistently guarding against these threats of a pandemic?
So one very tangible one, we learned that crowded indoor spaces that are poorly ventilated is just basically like a tinderbox for, you know, again, extending the fire analogy, but a tinderbox for infections. And so we've learned a lot about the importance of improving building ventilation. And there is still so much more we can be doing on that front. They've got day-to-day benefits, including it's just nicer to work in those spaces. You tend to be more productive and you can reduce sicknesses all around. So there's a lot of benefits to taking those steps now. And that's very similar to what we've done with buildings for fire. We've made them generally fire, you know, safer. We can similarly make buildings infection safer. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I think, you know, we've built more of a culture of safety around thinking about respiratory infections and how to protect ourselves. We are having much more of a conversation of the importance of seasonal vaccinations and making sure that we prioritize that. We don't just skip it. You know, it used to be when I'd tell people, like, you should really get a flu shot, they say, oh, I don't really need it. Last time I had the flu, I was fine. And I'd say, well, you know, it's not just for you. It also can help protect like grandma. Right. And I remember people like looking at me strangely because that hadn't occurred to them. We've had a societal-wide conversation about how our health choices affect others. And I think that that's equipping people to make decisions in different ways. You know, I think people are making different decisions. I happened to talk to someone in our neighborhood that wanted to socialize outside because they had like a lingering cough. And, you know, we've learned better that taking things outdoors helps. So I think there's a lot of stuff that we can and should do. And then I think on the bigger kind of ticket item side, I mean, you know, there's a lot more attention to thinking about how we expedite the development of what we call medical countermeasures, things like vaccines and tests and medicines for future pandemic threats. You know, the other kind of list of pathogens that we worry could cause either a serious epidemic or a pandemic.
What are your biggest concerns as an expert in how these diseases move, whether it's COVID resurging or a new disease? And is there a particular vulnerability you see that has yet to really be addressed?
I mean, I think one of the biggest challenges right now is the political moment that we're in. And, you know, at the kind of early and days of COVID and sort of the height of the pandemic, I thought, this is it. I will never again have to do any kind of consciousness raising exercise because people have just are living through what is arguably the worst pandemic in a century. They will know the risk of not taking action. And while I think that's true, I think people do know. I think there's also been a lot of unfortunate politicization of very, I think, simple and not even really particularly controversial steps that we can take.
So if that type of politicization is a real roadblock and threat to future pandemics, how might we prevent it come the next global health emergency?
I think where some of the pushback and political rancor emerged was in part because some of our pandemic approaches weren't necessarily things that the public fully signed off on. You know, I think people who try to just kind of wave that away as just something unfortunate that we shouldn't pay attention to are frankly wrong, because, you know, there is no government in the world, certainly not no democratic government, that can compel a nation of 300 million plus people to take actions that they don't think are in their best interest. So we either need to figure out better what actions people are willing and able to take, or, you know, come up with new ones, or try to get people to the side of the actions that we think they should take. I would argue that there are a lot of really great examples that exist out there at the kind of state and local level that we need to harvest to make sure that our future pandemic playbooks reflect the values and innovative strategies that communities did very much pursue, and maybe steer clear of the ones that they have decided are non-starters. So I think we need to do a lot more deliberative work, a lot more community engagement, and we need to involve, you know, state and local stakeholders to help us define what our response to future pandemics should look like. We have to know what works, what they're willing to do, and what's aligned with their values. And I think you'll find that there's a lot more options out there that don't necessarily involve some of the more politically charged measures that were taken, like mask mandates or school closures. I think those kind of one size fit all, you know, top down mandatory approaches have challenges, particularly over the long haul, but we need to think of what are strategies that work better for communities. I think there's more out there that have yet to be unearthed, but that's where I see the steps are. And I think it's very much doable and within our reach.
Jennifer Nuzzo, thank you so much for coming on to Trending Globally.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your highlighting these issues.
The COVID-19 pandemic reminded everyone of the world-stopping power of a deadly infectious virus. And as Jennifer says, hopefully, we'll build prevention of future health emergencies into our laws and day-to-day lives. This will require more than just improving things like testing, vaccination rates, or the ventilation of buildings. As our next guest explains, the last 4 years have made disturbingly clear that there are broader issues of biosecurity, that is, the protection of humans and animals against viruses and other harmful biological agents, that we also need to urgently address. On top of the pandemic, in the last 4 years, conflicts around the world have brought the weaponization of biological threats back into the spotlight in the world of international security. Wilmot James is a senior advisor to the Brown Pandemic Center. Prior to that, he served as a member of parliament and shadow minister of health in South Africa, and as chair of the Center for Pandemic Research at Columbia University. Wilmot James, thank you so much for coming on to Trending Globally.
No, thank you very much for having me. This is a real pleasure.
I wondered if we could just start for listeners with this word biosecurity. And what is biosecurity? How do you define it?
So understanding of this term biosecurity is essentially one where you have to keep dangerous bugs in safe hands. That is, they belong in the laboratory and just keep them there. But it's more than laboratories. It's also biobanks. It's also when bad bugs are transported from place to place. And so biosecurity really means a whole range of things in policy terms. So first of all, there's this new thing called biosurveillance. As opposed to having surveillance of pathogens, you can sample air quality, for example, or placing a mechanism in an airport to see whether there is a signal of something coming by checking what's in the environment. And it's called biosurveillance. The second is laboratory security. More higher level science work, say for example on vaccine development, you need to know what are the dangerous pathogens in a particular region, and then you need to be able to test those safely in a laboratory. So the question is, how do you keep those bugs safe in a laboratory when it's necessary to do experimental work on those?
As Wilmot explained, the last 4 years have seen a lot of changes to how we think about biosecurity. First off, COVID-19 brought more attention and resources to the very issue. In much of Africa, for example, the disease itself, as well as the rapid construction of biolabs, made the risks of poor biosecurity much more visible to policymakers.
Just to talk about it from my own experience coming from Africa is that I've been going back to South Africa on a regular basis. I speak to politicians. This is before COVID-19. So we were looking at an accelerating cycle of pandemics, you know, starting off with the flus of the turn of the century, and you know, faced Ebola in West Africa, faced Zika. We could see, you know, what was happening, and that we wanted to make sure that you have a system of health security in place. And we checked what the capability was in all countries on the biosecurity and biosafety front, and found that the figures were actually alarming, that countries were not prepared to deal with an accidental. They didn't have the protocols for it. This is prior to COVID-19. When I go back to South Africa now, people don't say it's not an issue for us anymore. Largely because of the COVID-19 experience and the fact that they saw what the risk was with the rapid construction of laboratories without having safe mechanisms into place. And so now when you talk to policymakers about biosecurity, they understand the risk a lot more. So that's why it's become what we call, we've got traction on this question.
But it wasn't just the pandemic that brought traction to the issue of biosecurity. That's because biosecurity also deals with the weaponization of biological threats, not just preventing accidents. And in that regard, traction came from another global event.
It's COVID-19, but it's also the Russia-Ukraine war, right? So Russia invades Ukraine, and it accuses Ukraine of making biological weapons. In the meantime, Russia has been making biological weapons for a long time. So we know from the Soviet Union days, today, Russia is an unbroken line of an elaborate biological weapons program. They tried to weaponize Ebola, which you know as a high case fatality, and other pathogens, and they were tested by stringing chimpanzees on an island and spraying them.
Oh, God.
And so that was quite a while back when the Soviet Union was in full-blown effort when it came to the weaponizing of pathogens. But an extensive biological weapons program.
Right. So as far as countries go that present a risk of the weaponizing of infectious diseases, a country like Russia would be high up on that list.
Yes. So what happened is this particular issue got caught up in this war. But it just highlighted the question. And then, of course, Russia made a complaint against Ukraine to the Biological Weapons Convention, and that had to be investigated. And they basically raise the temperature in that way. So that's where a lot of the awareness came about.
It's a fascinating confluence you describe of the Ukraine conflict and the pandemic, these two things that weren't seemingly clearly related, but they've both helped bring these issues, it seems like, more into the forefront and the connection between international security and biohazards.
Exactly. So we have to think very carefully of what pandemic response means and prevention means in situations of civil strife and war. So we have to ask the question, what's happening in Palestine and Israel as well? So what's happening to the labs there? You know, are pathogens kept in safe hands? There are lots of labs in Israel, some in Palestine as well. So there's this new interest in understanding that. It's one thing to have pandemic response in times of peace, which is hard enough, difficult enough. What about in circumstances of war where you require certain kinds of behavior on the part of people, but they're trying to survive and dodge bullets, basically? What happens then? And then to have interventions that actually keep pathogens safe in those circumstances.
So what does that look like, thinking about infectious diseases and biological threats as both national security and a public health problem? Like how does it change when those two get combined?
So today I'm convening a number of meetings where I bring together public health and national security. The truth is also that national security is investing a lot in prevention. So in the United States, it's always been the case that the Pentagon has invested an enormous amount of money in this area, partly because of the obvious wish to protect U.S. soldiers abroad, right, against any dangerous infectious disease outbreaks. So the investment infrastructure when it comes to global health security involves the defense departments. And so we have to have a balance between those security interests and the public health interests coming together. And it's possible to do that, for those communities to come together to do the right thing. But there are other countries that have weaponized pathogens over a very long period of time. We knew it existed in Iraq, for example. I don't think it exists anymore. That was dismantled. We're not sure what's happening in North Korea, but still. So there are states that are involved in developing biological weapons and chemical weapons. So the Biological Weapons Convention sits there as a global treaty to deal with it. And so what we are trying to do today is make sure that countries comply with the BWC. So when today, when we speak about health security, it's not just public health, it's also defense. It's also national security.
As an expert on these types of organizations and these protocols, what keeps you up at night the most right now when it comes to public health and biosecurity? What are the biggest holes you see?
So the biggest holes, in my view, would be accidental leaks, just accidents that are committed not because people want to cause harm, but because they're neglectful or because government has not invested enough money in the technology and the training to ensure that, you know, pathogens stay in safe hands. So a lot of the work that we do now is to advocate for governments to spend more. And often governments would build nice labs, they can't maintain it. And then you've got serious problems in terms of having to mothball some labs or they just don't function properly. So it's really important to have great policies when it comes to biosecurity and to be able to invest the kind of money in the infrastructure, the people and the systems and the technology to make sure that they're sustainable in the longer term. So that's the work that we are busy with right now.
But as Wilmot explains, in the world of biosecurity, there are new threats just around the corner as well.
The difficulty is that the innovation in science is so rapid. It doesn't happen within government. It happens largely in the private sector. And you've seen the discussion around artificial intelligence being able to power more rapid diagnosis, good thing. More effective surveillance, a great thing, but it can also be abused. So when it comes to developing synthetic pathogens, for example, powered by AI, that's technically possible. And so it's a moving target, understanding at risk and so on. So we have to catch up. We're always trying to catch up. And I think there's a lot of thinking going into that now because we don't quite know what the risk is with AI-powered synthetic pathogen development.
That is a pretty terrifying combination of words, AI-powered synthetic pathogen development. But thankfully, many of these risks are getting more attention than they were in 2019. Because when it comes to crises like pandemics, and this goes back somewhat to what Jennifer Nuzzo also described.
We've got this unfortunate cycle of what's called panic and neglect. So there's a small kind of window to do something. That window is still open, but it will close quickly. So we have to do things quickly.
Well, I wish you all the luck and the speed in the world in making change during that window's opening. So Wilmot James, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us on Trending Globally.
It's a great pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
This episode was produced by me, Dan Richards, and Zach Hirsch, with production assistance from Eric Emma. We'll have links to Brown's School of Public Health and Pandemic Center in the show notes, as well as links to our website where you can find a transcript of this conversation in the next couple of days. If you like the show, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you haven't subscribed to Trending Globally, please do that too. If you have any ideas for guests or topics of future episodes, send us an email at trendingglobally@brown.edu. Again, that's all one word, trendingglobally@brown.edu. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Trending Globally.